scheduled for a work session.
We just have it scheduled for a public hearing, but
it's on in 30 or 40 minutes.
Yeah, I thought we'd get more. I thought we'd get some public testimony, but maybe not.
Maybe not. Doesn't look like it.
Open the Senate Revenue Committee Tuesday, February 15th. So today's agenda is brief but important. We're just going to do our final cut at Senate Bill 480, which is our general tax amnesty and abusive tax shelter omnibus bill. And so, committee, what you have before you, and the key document is this one. Right here, because what we did is we outlined all the choices that we have before us of what's in the bill and what's out of the bill, because my hope would be after we do this, we've heard it twice, this would be the third time, is that we'll bring it back when Dexter's ready, and that's going to, he said this, since it's so big and broad in nature, it'll take a couple weeks, but then we'd bring the bill back for a work session once we have all of these decisions made, and probably allow one more public hearing just to make sure that everyone's got their chance at it. So I will open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 480. And Deborah, do you want to come up too, since you were part of the conversation on putting together the two elements of this, and the first section of the bill will be just on abusive tax shelters, and the second will be a very different conversation just on general amnesty programs. Paul Warner.
Okay. Mr. Chair, these are the key elements really based on discussions the committee had initially and also in conversations with the chair. The intent here is to lay out the key elements of a redraft of Senate Bill 480. So these would be developed as an amendment by Dexter. If the committee's in general acceptance, and we'll go ahead and get Dexter drafting on this as soon as we can. The way the bill would be structured is to have two distinct parts that actually I think could be viewed as standalone. The abusive tax shelter and the general amnesty programs, they're really aimed at different kinds of taxpayers. The one thing that we thought from an administrative standpoint is, unlike the California experience, which the voluntary compliance initiative was in 03 or in 04, and now the general amnesty is going on, so there were two distinct time periods, we thought in terms of for the department managing that and preventing some confusion that they be run concurrently, so over the same time period. But I'll just walk through what the key elements are and address any questions you have. The first is the abusive tax shelters that would be open to both personal and corporate taxpayers. One thing though to keep in mind, contrary to what my initial thought was, and Deborah pointed out when she was going through the results of California, is it was mostly personal taxpayers who came forward during that voluntary compliance initiative. I think it was almost 90% personal and about 10% corporate. So that surprised me a little bit, but that the California VCI did have allowed for both. There would be two types of transactions that are clearly laid out in IRS code. They're listed transactions is the term, or tax shelter transactions. That language currently is contained in House Bill 2486, which Representative McPherson went through with you. That language could be retained in this bill. There's a third set of transactions which would give the Department of Revenue some rule-setting authority for transactions with no economic substance. So they would be able to go beyond in this rulemaking process the IRS code into transactions that they would deem based on these rules to be and have no economic substance.
So what do we mean, no economic substance? No bearing on...
If a transaction has no economic substance, it means that it was the sole purpose of carrying that transaction out was to avoid taxes.
Okay.
I mean, it had no effect on profitability.
Okay, I just need clarification with the term. Okay.
And that's, but I think the point though is that, you know, the above listed transactions and the abusive tax shelter transaction, those also have no economic substance. But this would allow the department to define that even more broadly and to pick up some transactions that may not fit strictly in that code. Mm-hmm. So it does give them a little bit more authority.
And we could sunset. We discussed sunsetting that provision. Also, taking a look at are there transactions that they're finding out there, and having them come back at some point 4 years from now and letting us know, are there new rules being promulgated or new programs, tax shelters being promulgated that we should know about that the laws that we've put in place don't get at.
Right. Okay.
And I'm open on that if the committee we discuss.
Well, and it seems to me, Mr. Chair, that if we're trying to, let's say, recoup whatever hasn't been paid in, we need to give them as much latitude as possible in the beginning to see, and as long as within our, you know, our policies and confines as to what we want. But, I mean, there may be stuff out there that we don't know about, and this will give us an opportunity, at least the department, to advise us, like you're saying, maybe at the next session, what they've found, and do we need to maybe be a little bit more inclusive and in the actual statutes, or is does this process work without having much fallout from taxpayers?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's the. I mean, we had discussed in the first hearing, Senator Brzezinski, about how much latitude to give to the our discretion to give to the Department of Revenue. This would give them a little more discretion than we were initially going to. I'm comfortable with it after we talked about it for a while. But want to make sure the committee is equally comfortable giving them that extra latitude that we were not going to give them initially.
Well, if you're asking me, I've got the thumbs up.
Great.
the next element there is, remember that the California law also dealt with promoters of these transactions. And one of the things that we tried to be mindful of was your colleagues in the Ways and Means Committee, and to try to keep the fiscal impact as small as possible. And so the way it's laid out there, it would be that promoters presumably would be registered in other states. California requires them to register, or other states that are looking at this or the IRS. So if they are registered in those states, and they must register in Oregon, thinking that would be a relatively low-cost monitoring system for the department to maintain.
So if I could, Paul, if we're saying that they have to only register here in Oregon if they're registered in other states, why wouldn't we want them to register anyway?
Senator Brzezinski, the thought is that would the department wouldn't have to carry out a separate compliance and monitoring system.
Okay.
It would simply state, and they're going to be getting information from other states, particularly from California, saying these are the promoters that are registered here.
Right.
And most of the promoters, my understanding, are operating in a multi-state system. They're not going to be targeting one individual state and operate exclusively there. So I think we're going to pick up most of them in this through this kind of language.
I'm just wondering, is there a reason not to just have everyone? If they're promoting something in the state, it just seems to me it's almost like following who your agent is for service. Mm-hmm. And having something that the department's going to be aware of. And I understand the philosophy that someone may not come after Oregon as a specific exclusive state, but at the same time, it might happen. And is it something that we should just build into it? If it's not that big of a deal, it shouldn't make that much of a difference requiring it. Or is there something that's going to put the promoters, not at risk, but I don't know if other states require, let's say, registration if they're exclusively in their own state.
You know, the decision point there was FTE
Okay.
To have someone, I mean, it was just, and I open on this one too, but to have someone, if we put the stricter language in there that you must register if you're in Oregon, then it becomes, I think, an FTE decision for the Department of Revenue because they have to hire someone to promulgate and look for and ensure that everyone in Oregon is. And my strong inclination is on this is that because of our proximity to California and the nature of these transactions, which tend to focus on, well, California is just the best market for it because of the number of companies and high net worth individuals, that the promoters that are in California would also probably be here, but you probably wouldn't find someone that's in Oregon that's ignoring California promoting these because of the market size.
Right.
Therefore, we could just save some FTE by linking, just taking advantage of California being so close to us.
Right, but if they're in California or operating in California and they come into Oregon, then there's going to be an obligation for them to register in Oregon.
Correct.
So we're going to have the FTEs to handle that load of registrations. And what I thought I heard was that it sounds like we're going to be getting 95% of the people needing to register because they're in multi-states, and it's only maybe another 5% that we may be missing. I just throw that out. I mean, I'm going to go where the chair wants to go on that. It's just one of those things that seems like if we potentially have someone saying, here's a way that we can get around this, and...
I don't know, Deborah, do you have any thoughts on this? We certainly circled around this about three times,
right,
in developing.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Deborah Buchanan, Department of Revenue. Senator Przanski raises some good points. I would simply say that if we're able to piggyback on what another state is doing, that relieves us of the obligation to tell promoters, here's what you must do. If you're doing this, you must register. If you're doing this, you must register. All we have to say is if you're required to register in California, you need to register with us. So I think there is less workload in going that direction. Another thing that we might do is if you want to report back, we may bring that back also as part of our report to say we've captured what we think are the majority of the promoters, or we haven't been able to get registration for these people, and we think it's important to do that and include that in the report as well as any recommended changes at that point.
That's fine with me. And what I understand, though, is that for these individuals, when we say other states, we are talking about the other 49 states. So if we have a group on the East Coast, they're going to get captured just as well as people that are registered in California.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah, and I mean, it's a very good point, Senator Przanski. If there is a loophole here and you have sophisticated promoters, which people tend to be somewhat sophisticated that are in this field, if they found a loophole that Oregon, they could actually come set up shop here and then go to the other states because we haven't required registration, then I would ask the department to let us know about that in a couple of years. I doubt that
right.
would occur. But
and I guess the duty would be if they were required to register, let's say in California, if they went there or whatever their state, then their obligation would come back to have to register because now they're registered in California,
right.
even though they may be originally situated within the state of Oregon. Okay, fair enough.
The next point there is on penalties, and these are 20% penalty per transaction, and the penalties would be cumulative for the three types. So, you know, if you had transactions that were listed transactions plus a transaction that was deemed of no economic substance by the department, it would be in effect 40%. So you would accumulate those two. The next set of points is on the voluntary compliance initiative. So this is where we will have to, and what we'll do, if you're comfortable with these parameters, we will try to come back with you, to you next week with a revenue impact estimate. Keep in mind that will be a one that we will have a high degree of variance on, but we'll give you an unbiased estimate of what we think would come in, and that will give you another
guess high.
Use a good clean crystal ball.
Okay. So some of the key things are the number of years you go back. This, as it's outlined now, would go back 8 years, matching the California VCI. So that picks up the, 4 years, really, of the stock market bubble when the tail really peaked in 2000. So you're remember that that's where the incentive to look for these kinds of tax shelters really increased. So I think you'd be picking up quite a bit of that revenue at this time. One of the arguments about going back that far is that you're looking at a sophisticated group of taxpayers, therefore the records would exist probably more than they would for a general taxpayer who hasn't been paying. So, and I'll get to that distinction in a minute when you look at the general amnesty. The time period is set here would be July 1 to October 1, which would be a 90-day period. So the department would set that out and publicize that as the time period. One of the things that would be important, I think, in terms of expectation is for the message also to be the department's continuing to gather information during this period. So that, a recognition that if you don't take advantage of this, then they've gone through this time period to try to identify people before it even starts. All penalties would be waived, but interest would not be under the VCI. Again, that's like California's. A distinct difference with California is no appeal rights. And the thinking there on the discussions was that administratively the appeal rights opens up all kinds of different additional costs, for example, uncertainties as to whether revenue is actually really revenue or going to have to go back out in the appeal process. So that was the thinking behind that. So that would be a distinction from California. Finally, all taxpayers would be eligible during the amnesty period. One of the issues, remember, that you've talked about is those that have been identified by the department versus those who haven't been. And the way this would be set up is, even if you've been identified by the department, you're eligible for the amnesty during this period.
So that's a key decision also, is that you're allowing folks who we already know about to go ahead and use this as kind of an invitation back into the system, which was a big decision to make because the department at some level feels they might be able to bring them back in anyhow. But it's just kind of leading with another carrot. It was a close call, at least on my part.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds to me that what we're basically saying, we're not going to potentially assess penalties at this point if you come in. But if you do come in the program, one, the trade-off is they're not going to be able to appeal. And so we kind of, like you're saying, use a carrot to get them in with the understanding. It's kind of like the DOE diversion program. You now have to plead guilty up front, realizing that once you plead guilty and you enter the program, if you fail to complete the program, you're going to come back before the judge and get sentenced.
Exactly. And most of the folks that or at least what I've learned from California is if you're in the system, if they know about you, you most likely know you're going to have to pay those penalties and interest. And so therefore, that July 1 date, if we do, Governor signs this in April or May, that July 1 date will become extremely important because all those penalties that you've been racking up will then dissolve for those. So I think it's a real enticement. That was one of the tougher decisions of do you. But to me, on a 51-49, you allow them back in because I think it's kind of keeps with the spirit of what we're trying to do, which is really have the carrots lead the sticks.
Can I go back to the date?
Yes.
Is 206. Is that correct, or is it 205?
Senator, the way it's laid out here, it would be 2006. And that's to give the department time to gear up for it and prepare the publications due.
Okay.
One of the key issues is, and notice I've put the California, some of their publicity is publicity about it. Now, it's probably less important here than it is about the general amnesty. But again, the recommendation we have from an administrative standpoint is to run those two concurrently.
Well, let's talk about that. So that's a good question. It seems to me, does the department need that much time, a year, to gear up for this. It seems to me you'd want it at least coming closer to the heels of when we enacted a new law.
Mr. Chairman, I don't know that we need an entire year, but what is important is when you do it during the year. We wouldn't want to try to operate this during our processing season, so that pretty much just takes out January through May. And later in the year might be a possibility. Later in 05, for example, might be a possibility.
Can we start it? How about we start it? And I know the holidays are, you know, Christmas, but it fits the holidays. It's the spirit of the holidays. Could we start it September 1st and run it through December 1st of this year?
Mr. Chairman, can I get back to you on that?
Yeah, that's more interesting to me than...
Yeah. And could you just, besides looking at September 1, how early could you start based on when we get the sign? Because, I mean, if I'd be more inclined to give the taxpayer a broader window of time to get in if we can do it where it's not going to interfere with the you know, the processing. So if you had December 31 as your cutoff date, how soon could we start it, understanding if we get the governor to sign or get it through here to the House and the governor sign with the emergency clause, that should give us 90 days or so maybe to actually get the PR out before we would actually have the program up and going.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, we'll get Dexter for a definitive answer on this, but I'm pretty sure we could not have an emergency clause on this. It would be a tax administration bill. So,
well, if we can't, then that means it doesn't go into effect until January 1 of this next year.
Right.
Yeah.
So then we might be back to where we're...
Or September or October, if
it
has 90 days. It
could be 90 days after signing down. So that, if it's...
Yeah, cut it out. We're going to get out of here. We're going to get out of here.
It's still Christmas.
I'm with
The voice of reason, Senator Starr, brings us back to, well, maybe September it is then. That'll put positive pressure on us.
We're back to 95 of the pea-picking season.
It's positive pressure. Well, I'd like to look at that, and keeping with Senator Starr's comment of us cutting it out, if we could get out of here 90 days, September would still be an opportunity, or October.
One possible, of course, the other thing is that we've got 90 days here, which, you know, California is a 60-day. Now, do you remember what their VCI was?
106 days.
It was 106 days, so that was a little bit longer. Okay, so that's another variable there would be how long the amnesty would run for.
Yeah, okay.
But we will get back to you with some information and dates, and Deborah will check with the department to see what might be feasible for them. The next portion of the bill would be dealing with general amnesty, and again, this could be viewed as a separate and distinct from the abuse of tax shelter. So these could be viewed as standalone or separate bills if you want to view them that way. Deborah talked with folks of the department that would be really administering this, and the message they gave was to keep it simple. So that's something that we tried to look at. And that would be, of course, not only for the department in terms of administering, but also for taxpayers, so they'll be able to understand what it is that they're looking at. Again, the time period would be the same as the VCI, so whatever changes you would make there would apply here. For administrative ease and just for relevance, it's limited to personal income taxpayers only. Again, thinking in terms of the much more complicated corporate returns that have a much longer time lag on them. Non-filers would be eligible. So if you haven't filed a return, you could come forward during this amnesty period. And amended returns would be eligible to correct an overstatement of a deduction, an illegitimate deduction, or an income understatement. So that would all of those taxpayers be able to come forward, file a new return to reflect the more accurate information. The DOR has the right to place applicants under abusive tax shelter programs. So if somebody comes forward and says, I'm applying for the general amnesty, and the department says, well, you know, this is really an abusive tax shelter that caused your understatement, then they could put them into that program. interest and penalty would be waived for those who would presumably be non-filers who have had no contact with the DOR, so people that they have out there we don't know about. Those are the people that were most likely to be true new revenue that we wouldn't have gotten otherwise. And so they would be treated somewhat differently. Others who have been identified by the department and who are being in some ways monitored, they would have their penalties waived if they came forward during this period and basically paid off their liabilities, but their interest would not be forgiven during this period. So this is consistent, at least our interpretation of what the committee talked about, this two-tiered kind of approach. So you're including both groups, but not treating them the same, recognizing that in a sense what you're doing with those that they've already identified is you're largely speeding up collections rather than getting new revenue. So it will increase the revenue impact certainly for that time period and for the biennium, but over, say, a 5 or 6 year period, it probably wouldn't. Eligible tax years for amended returns would be 02, 03, 04, and of course those who have not filed at all could go back further in the past. There's a post-amnesty penalty of 25% of ordinary penalties, and those can get as high as 100% for non-filers over 3 years, Deborah, is it?
It is as high as 100% if they file 3 years late.
3 years. And then there would be a sunset on those penalties after the amnesty process and the time period has been worked through, and then you go back to the older penalties. One of the things that the committee talked about was a public listing after an amnesty period of the top 100, those with the top 100 largest tax liabilities. So that would be after the amnesty period. The Department of Revenue could post the names of those individuals and the amount that they owed as an additional incentive to take advantage of the amnesty. And, of course, Washington does that. I think we had some testimony on that from other states. The department does currently have some criminal prosecution penalty legislation or language. They haven't tended to use it, but still that would be waived as part of this, too, and that would be made clear to those that would take advantage of it. There would be an installment payment program. Most of these amnesties have that for those that come forward, those terms could be set under rule with DOR. One of the issues, particularly Senator George brought up, is for some additional incentives for a whistleblower program. There is legislation on the books now, which has not been used again, so we put this in there as a review of that program. And finally, there would be a requirement for participants to pledge future compliance, and we discussed this with the chair at some length, how to phrase that, and that might be something the committee would want to consider. Because remember in the California amnesty, you come forward and say, okay, I agree to file my returns for 05 and 06, but then you're worried about the message, okay, after 06, then what? You know, so it would be I think there would need to be some thought in terms of how that would be worded so that it doesn't come across as an unintended consequence.
Yeah, I'm really open on that. Do you say require into perpetuity all taxpayers? And also, we talked about the issue of that could exclude, you know, the line on that we have up the list here. That, and this is a big decision too, that we're waiving interest and penalty for those who have no contact with the department. That population of tax protesters, does that final who you've enticed into the system perhaps with no interest or penalties, on the final line you have requiring them to participate, which could be a deal breaker for those individuals. And I wouldn't want one line of requiring them to pledge to keep them out of the system if they otherwise would come in the system. And the department seemed to think that could, that simply signing their name to a pledge that they're going to participate in with the laws of Oregon might in some ways be enough to keep someone out of the system. And so for me, that led me to think, well, perhaps we just waive that requirement, although I do like the actual signing of your name saying, since the state is participating with you, then you will also participate and pledge to future compliance.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Metzger.
Well, the only thing on that would be, I don't know how significant the signing of the pledge would be anyway, number one. But number two is, you've now brought somebody into the system, so we know who they are now. So I'm not so sure it's that important, because we would be looking for them now that we had them in the system.
Mm-hmm.
So if that was, if the signing of the name created some problem for them, I'd say that's not much of a problem for us, because now we've got somebody in the system and we'll be able to watch and track them. And I don't know that the signature is very valid for anything anyway.
Mr. Chair, Deborah had given me an article out of the National Tax Journal that I read this weekend on, it was a study of Michigan and the Michigan amnesty program in the mid-80s. And it was really the only empirical study I think I've seen that really looks at what happens to the people that take advantage of amnesty afterwards. And it looked at 2 years later. And in the Michigan case, it found that I believe it was 68% had filed returns 2 years later after they had gotten into the amnesty program. Now, the overall percentage was higher, so, I mean, they were still at a higher non-compliance rate than the general population, but they, 68%, two-thirds had stayed in the system, and they didn't have any kind of any explicit kind of pledge or anything. So there was clear evidence that, as Senator Metzger points out, that people knew they're in the system, and they do have a higher compliance rate later.
Once you've brought them back in the system. Well,
a couple of years later.
Huh. And that's, I didn't know that Michigan. I mean, I feel fine with just waiving that. I don't know if there's a power in actually signing your name, but I'm very amenable to there was answer.
Yeah, I think Senator Metzger's brought up a good point, and based on what Paul's reviewed over the weekend, you read that? but I mean, it's one of those things. Once they're in the system,
get a life.
We've gotten cut it out and get a life out of the vice chair.
This is at halftime of the basketball.
Oh, okay. Well, in that case,
the tax criminal of Michigan.
But no, I think that it's one of those things that I don't know if anyone would say they wouldn't come out in the amnesty program because they were required to sign it. But it doesn't really serve a purpose. I mean, like Senator Metzger says, once they're in the system, they're in the system.
You know,
I will be able to track them. So,
yeah, and this is the people we probably pay closer attention to, I would think, because they've been out of the system for so long. Jody's just shaking her head. Jody, it's a public hearing, so we'll have, before we gavel down in a few minutes here, we'll have you come up. Senator Sharp, feelings on just waving that pledge?
Well, I think up front that it probably would have some deterrent ability, or would deter some people from coming forward if they recognized up front that they were going to be signing this pledge. I don't know. I don't know those people very well that are not motivated to file their taxes, so I don't know what their thinking is. But it would seem to me that if they've chosen to be tax avoiders, that saying that I'm coming forward and I'm going to stay in the system might be difficult for them.
Yeah. 3-1. Yeah. So that will remove that provision. The other one I wanted to review is waiving the interest and penalties. That's a key decision also. And if folks are comfortable, I am, but it's certainly a big enticement to come back into the system.
Yeah, I think we should. Could do that. I think that's powerful. motivation to come forward.
Yeah, it's certainly an enticement.
Yeah.
That you will not pay any interest and no penalties. It's a huge enticement. Well, if Senator Brzezinski and Senator Metzger are comfortable.
Sure. Now, is that still followed by a bigger stick bill, as we talked about earlier afterwards, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, three lines
yeah.
down.
Yeah, sure.
Everything comes back and a little more.
Sure.
Any, Paul or Deborah, anything else that we... that we've missed. Well, we'll come back. So we'll return to this probably in a week or 10 days. Jody, did you want to please come up and let us know your thoughts? This will probably be our last. We'll have a public hearing, but we're hoping not to change it once we bring this back in a week or two.
Well, I just returned from D.C., and so I read this at about 5 this morning. So, somebody else in the committee called and said, we need to respond to this. So I feel a little disorganized, but, one of the things we're suggesting is...
your name.
Oh, excuse me. Jody Weiser, Portland, Oregon. Tax Fairness Coalition representative. We feel strongly, we did not suggest the general tax amnesty in our legislative agenda, and the reason we didn't is in reading what was happening in some other states, it looked to us like there wasn't any evidence that it brings in a lot of new tax money. And most states figured that all it did was accelerate the bringing in of income that would otherwise be reached. While there was some new income, you lost penalties and interest, and in many states they give up it part of the interest even, and so it was pretty much a wash. And when I talk with people from the Federation of Tax Administrators, they said the problem with general amnesties is that departments have to divert their resources to deal with the amnesty, and so the normal compliance work that they're trying to do and any increased compliance work they're trying to do kind of gets shuffled aside while they deal with these people who are coming in. And so I wanted to reiterate our suggestion that you really need to be increasing the department's budget by 15% a year for the next 2 years, which, if I recall correctly, it's in at $167 million, and that would mean $192 for this year and $221 million for the following year. So we're talking about significant jumps in funding. But then you could use these new hires to deal with it instead of diverting the energy that would be going towards things like the data matching programs and stuff that should keep more people in compliance. When I was in D.C. this last week, I heard that the Oregon, tax advocate, I think is her name, is her title for the IRS, is now saying that dishonesty in tax preparation costs on average $2,000 per taxpayer in increased taxes for everybody else. So, who is out there that's not filing appropriately is a pretty significant thing. And while the president has actually put a little bit of money into his budget for increased enforcement from the IRS, the Congress isn't passing that legislation. So, it's not bringing, they're not getting increased revenue at the IRS, where the number of personnel is down 36% since 1996. So we're, there's a hole there. So I think you really should consider tying to this or in other legislation real increases in the budget for the department. I have some questions just in reading it. One is just, have you asked yourself, are you just speeding revenue that would otherwise come in? Will you really collect anything different with this? And I don't know when a notice of deficiency is offered out. The legislation that I read last night for Senate Bill 480 said that anybody would be excluded from the process if they had received a notice of deficiency. And I don't know where in the audit and collection process that happens, but I really think that if we've identified somebody, that means the honest taxpayers have invested money catching these people. They shouldn't get out of it. They shouldn't get just you know, we've already put the effort in. They didn't come forward. So anybody that we've already identified and sent an audit letter to, and we're going to audit you because we have questions about your form, that should be a period. You know, that those people that we've found should not be eligible for an amnesty. I have found it hard to figure out what the current penalty structure is that people are being relieved of. I know that 100% is the most that one could be, have penalties put on them at this point in time, but I'm not sure, you know, what are all the different penalties that they're getting relieved from, and also, what's the penalty structure that 25% is being added to? Does that mean we're going to, the new penalty would be 125%? Or do we still have the 100% maximum penalty? I also questioned some of the timing that you questioned. It's 10.5 months from now, and this general amnesty is written as a one-year amnesty. That means that the revenue would be coming in a really long time from now.
We're going to try to bump that up.
Yeah, it sounds like you're trying to. And I think that having lots of time to advertise for a general amnesty particularly needs attention. And I thought you might even want to put in your bill that you want it advertised in print and radio spots, TV spots, and on billboards and in several languages, because you're going to have, you're going to reach a different audience in each of those places.
On that, Jody, we're talking to the department about, and they're looking into what kind of advertising we could do, and I guess the budget part, we are well in sync with the Ways and Means, which does the budget component of this, on this issue, and on compensation for agents and number of agents, and so I feel pretty good about the collaboration we've had on this bill and in this, and then what would be in the overall budget for the Department of Revenue to make sure they're kind of in alignment.
Mm-hmm. The people who are coming in either because they've been non-filers or because they've incorrectly filed their forms are undoubtedly amongst those taxpayers least driven by integrity in general. And I wonder if part of this bill couldn't include saying we're going to audit more of these people than we generally audit. I don't know what our percentage of audits are of a 1.5 million taxpayers, but if we normally audit 4%, it seems like we should jump that up for this population. Otherwise, they're filing a form, but nobody's really examining whether that form is still accurate or not. And I think that it would make sense for the people who come in and get a huge relief from penalties to have their forms scrutinized more than normal. In Section 5, Part 2, it says the department needs to wait until after the closure of the amnesty period. And it seems like if somebody has submitted early in an amnesty period, they should be able to go ahead and process an audit that they did and any additional income on a more timely basis than waiting. When we spoke with Richard Tsunemoto, who's head of one of the compliance divisions for the Department of Revenue, he said that currently they find somebody who's not paying their taxes, they bring them into the system, they get them paying their taxes, and 5 years later, half of them have fallen out of the system. And so I think the difference between saying we're going to watch them more carefully, well, our history is we let 50% of them drop back out of the system. So we either need to do something about upgrading our ability to watch whether somebody stays in the system and keep in the system, or we need that hook that we've left you out of the your penalties, but if you don't continue filing, you will have to pay the penalties you got out of.
And that's in the bill.
But you were just discussing leaving it out. That if they leave out the line that they said they were going to continue following, or they would have to pay the penalties. And so if you take that, if you strike that line, then they've gotten out of these penalties, and the onus is still on the honest taxpayer to go after them and keep them in the system. And that really brings me to the final point, and that is that we really feel that there should be not 100% relief from penalty. That there needs to be something that says to the people who've been paying honestly all along, you were doing it right. And these people, some of them are getting relieved of 90% of their tax, basically, if you say you're only going to have to pay 5%. Or there's a penalty of interest plus 10% or something. So there's some piece of penalty built in here, not just you won. Because if they've had the use of their money for that period of time, they have won if they just walk through the door free with it. It is, you know, there are whole sections to our major corporations that whose job it is to externalize taxes. And I think you're trying to set a change of mood which says we're going to be much more serious about collecting taxes. And I think to say, but if you hurry forward right now, we'll let you off the hook, it sets the wrong tone. I think that they still are getting out of an awful lot if you keep some penalty in there. So we urge you to increase the funding for the department so that doing amnesties doesn't undercut the basic work of the department. We urge you to consider some kind of penalty. It can be much, much reduced from normal penalties, but there should be some kind of penalty left in there. That there be a clear way of tracking these taxpayers into the future to make sure that they stay in the system. You know, if I don't pay my gas bill, I hear about it really soon. But I have never gotten a notice, why haven't you filed your income taxes on time? And I've had extensions numerous times, and sometimes the form went to the state and sometimes it didn't. There's not quick response, and I think that there needs to be quick response, especially with these taxpayers who've shown evidence of not having integrity be the call that brings them forward all the time. Thank you.
Thank you, and thank you for all the work, Jody. You guys have helped bring at least this day about that we're doing our final markup on a bill. Questions for Jody? Thank you. Many of your points are incorporated in terms of we're going to work on, I think, that day, bumping it up. The penalty, that's the big question. We do have, and I don't know if you have this form that we're working on.
I don't have that. I just had that bill that was on the Internet this morning.
So we'll get you one. But there is a post-amnesty penalty at 25%.
Right. I saw that.
Which accomplishes one. But the big question that you asked, and to me, like I said, it's a 5149, is the question of waiving. You put it as they've won, and in some ways, I agree. It's allowing folks who've decided not to file returns at all. But I don't know if it's just a gut decision. I like the idea of allowing them back in the system, and then we know who they are, and we can track them into the future. But I really like the idea of, and maybe it is conceding, you've won, you've eluded us up until this point, but come back, and a lot of your worst fears of criminal prosecution, civil prosecution, big penalties, big interest, that's going to go right to you.
Yeah, I guess this is more for Paul or for Deborah as to what the penalty would be if they were, you know, coming into the system. I just forget what the testimony was previously. And I mean, maybe we should look at a nominal amount.
Just to say, yeah.
I believe it's 5% first year, then 25% second year, and then 100% 3 years.
Okay. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Deborah Buchanan, Department of Revenue. The first level of penalty is 5% for failure to pay tax on time or failure to file the return on time, but it's based on the unpaid tax.
That's 5% for when? What time?
If you fail to pay your tax by the due date.
When? Okay.
If it goes more than 3 months, there's an additional 20% that's applied. So that gets it to 25%. If it goes on and the department contacts you and you have not filed, there's an additional 25%. So we're up to 50% now. For those taxpayers that don't file at least three consecutive years of returns by the due date of the third year, there is a 100% penalty applied to the tax on each year that's unpaid. However, there is a limit of 100% overall.
And Senator Krasinski, I think we were looking at this 25% post-amnesty penalty would be applied to whatever penalty you would have. So, in effect, if you've got a 100% penalty for 3 years, and then you didn't take advantage of the amnesty, and then afterwards the department found that you hadn't complied, it would be 125%.
Okay. Can I just make a suggestion to the committee?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, looking at these numbers, if we were going to, let's say, have some type of penalty, if we left it at just 5%, and just say everyone is going to be able to get out for 5%. That's the first 90-day penalty. That's something.
Mm-hmm.
And whether that's, and I don't know if that's something that's, I mean, there's a good point here. I mean, we pay our taxes on time, and we've done everything we're supposed to. Should there or should there not be some type of assessment for those who haven't
mm-hmm.
done that? And then when I think about it, if the majority of people that we're going to capture are going to be individuals, their tax obligation is probably going to be a lot less in the big picture compared to a corporate side. And if that's the case, maybe that would be a reasonable rate, and understanding that the corporations also were going to be, 5% of their obligation is probably going to be a bigger chunk of change than for an individual. So, I mean, I guess I would be willing to look at doing something like that, but of course we can't go. I think 5% would be the maximum, because at some point you're going to, really undercut the whole purpose of the
purpose of the program.
And
the only response to that is, this is an interesting question, is that this really is a one-time. Oregon's never done this; it's a one-time deal, and so to the 95% or whatever that are filing on time and playing by the rules, it is in some ways the wrong message. I would agree. I mean, if the message is those who didn't are getting the same benefits you got, so why should I not just wait till the next amnesty? But the fact that this is a one-time, three-month window is what compels me. But maybe, and I guess I would be more open to a nominal fee or like a $10 or $50 over 5%, because I just think the 5% could be, and we're just guessing, I mean, at what affects people's behavior. I mean, Senator Starr had it right. I don't think we know what mm-hmm. compels these folks. Well, I'm at the will of the committee on this one, because I don't have, I think.
Can we ask Deborah as to, from the department's perspective, as to when you see people, and I would limit it to the individuals that are coming into compliance, what their obligation is for, I mean, I guess it's pretty much across the board. You got people that don't follow 90 days, you got the 3 months, and you got the 1 year to 3 years. I'll just, if you can give us any focus or direction as to how much money are we actually looking at that most of these people on an average owe to the system.
Mr. Chair, Senator Krasinski, I don't have that information. What I did see just a few days ago was a list of the penalties that were imposed for 2004, and the number that sticks in my mind is the 100% penalty amounted to, I believe, $20 million. I can get you that information, but this would be so much easier if all of the people in this group were similar in characteristics, but they're not. Some of them are going to be the hardcore non-filers who have constitutional issues with the tax system, who believe that they shouldn't be paying taxes in the first place, who believe that it's illegal or immoral, or since we went to the gold standard, they don't have any income, or those type of people are in there. But then you also have the people who made a mistake, forgot to file 1 year, are scared to death now that someone is out there looking for them, and are afraid to come back into the system. So you have this whole spectrum of people, and you're trying to carve out something that's fair to everybody and works for all of them. It's very difficult to do. So keeping a small penalty structure for everyone could make sense, in the sense that they're then not getting away with anything. And yet, in some ways, it doesn't make sense, because then you're not saying, we want you back in here, we understand people have problems, and let's get everybody back on board. So I don't know how you do that. I don't have the answer for it.
Would this be something that the department would feel comfortable having the discretion to be able to impose the penalty if we put a cap on it, let's say either 3 or 5% based on the situations that the department, or is this something you think that we as the legislature should set the policy and just leave it, and then you get to implement it?
Mr. Chair, Senator Prezanski, we would much prefer that you set the policy, because we cannot see into people's minds and know what their motives were.
And just from a marketing standpoint, I see this as you market it to folks, I don't want it to have, and the department will tell you how much. After they take a look at your books, they're going to tell you kind of how much penalty you owe.
Right. Well, Mr. Chair, I guess from my perspective, I'm willing to go where the committee wants to go. I'd be comfortable going up to, I say up to, a maximum of 5% penalty if we're going to do one. And I'd be willing to see something less than that, just to have something above the threshold of people walking out or without the system. But if the rest of the members want to, let's say, give everyone a true amnesty without penalty, I'll support that as well.
What I will do, and go ahead, Chuck, please.
So, Deborah, did you say that in 2004 you collected $20 million in penalties, 100% penalties?
Mr. Chair, I believe that those were the penalties that were set up on the system, not those that were collected.
Right. Okay.
And I would want to emphasize, too, that those will include people that we have found and issued notices of determination and assessment because they have not filed. So that is the best guess as to the tax that they owe and the penalty that would be charged. That doesn't reflect penalty waivers or when they come in and file a return and actually don't owe tax, and the penalty then is gone. So that's the gross amount that was set up in the system, is my recollection.
So an amnesty gives that amount up. An amnesty with no penalty would give that amount up.
But no.
Mr. Chair, if all of those taxpayers qualified for amnesty and filed, and the bill said the penalty will be forgiven, then whatever penalty was imposed would go away.
But I'm led to believe that a lot of those folks are just, that $20 million we're not going to get. I think the data suggests that we're not going to get that $20 million, and this is trying to recoup at least part of that. But what I'll do on this is we can kind of kick it around as a committee, and I will go to each member on the floor and talk to Senator George, and then I'll get it back to Paul, kind of where, I don't know if there's going to be a consensus, but the majority of the committee is on this question, and I'll get to Paul on that this afternoon, and that would be the final provision of this bill. Thank you very much. Thank you. I hope you didn't take the red eye back from Washington.
Actually, I did, but I love it.
Oh.
I like to through the pipe.
That is the first person. Well, the treasurer and you both love that flight. With that, we will close the public. Oh, please. I'm sorry. Please. Good morning.
Good morning. My name is Arthur Towers. I'm the political director for Service Employees Union Local 503. And I wanted to testify on the bill just briefly to flag for the committee that our union represents the frontline workers who actually are out there collecting the taxes and going through this process. And as they look at the legislation and the overall process, they're generally favorable towards the idea of a tax amnesty program. They have some concerns about the estimates of what might be available to be collected, and as you've discussed this morning, that's a pretty wide open topic. They also have some insight into the mechanics of exactly how this program would work. And thirdly, to echo some of the comments from the previous witness, they are somewhat concerned about the staffing, both to do the work, but more so after the amnesty period in terms of making sure that the stick is big enough to get the job done. We're really pleased that you're working so closely with the Ways and Means Committee on the budgeting process. I hope that we're able to bring some of the frontline workers into the Capitol over the course of the next week to visit individually with committee members and perhaps at your next hearing to talk through some of the various things that they're seeing actually on the ground right now.
Thank you. If you could do that sooner rather than later, I mean, this is obviously a two-chamber process, but
absolutely.
We're in terms of perfecting it before it leaves the Senate, we're kind of moving
on.
And the idea behind that is we wanted to get this out because this has, we need to work with on the budget of the department to ensure that we have enough folks there. We've talked extensively with the Ways and Means folks on that question, and that they're compensated enough that we get the right people to do that job.
Right.
And so we've had, or I have had, a number of conversations just on that and getting them up to date on this bill as it moves forward. But it's one we want to get done early, obviously, because we're asking the department to bump up the dates and we need staffing. This one will need a lot of time to think through.
Mr. Chair, I appreciate that. We'll get people here in the next few days.
Great. Other thoughts or comments? Sorry, I almost missed you there.
No problem.
We'd have to reopen.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, sir. Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 480, unless there was someone else. And we are done till
there's no close
till Wednesday. Adjourned.